Are you looking to connect with a diverse audience of developers? Look no further. You can partner with us here at the Code Newbie Podcast, and we'll help get your message out to our incredible listeners in an ad just like this one, led by me, your host. Contact us by emailing sponsors@codenewbie.org. Welcome to the Code Newbie Podcast, where we talk to people on their coding journey in hopes of helping you on yours. I'm your host, Saran, and before we kick off the show, I want to tell you about our incredible sponsors. Today, I am so excited because we have Quincy Larson, teacher of Free Code Camp, with us. Quincy, you want to say hi?
Hey, everyone.
So I have to give credit to David V. Williams on Twitter, who officially made this connection. Quincy, I've known about you and obviously you've heard of Free Code Camp for a very, very long time, and David finally put us together. So thank you, David, so much. Here's your official shout out. So Quincy, tell us what Free Code Camp is.
Sure. So Free Code Camp is an open source community that helps people learn to code and then practice coding by building projects for nonprofits.
So you call yourself a teacher of Free Code Camp, but I think that's being a little humble because you started Free Code Camp, right?
Right, but I guess I'm a career teacher and school administrator, and I identify very closely with the teaching profession and its ethos and techniques. And I think... I do a lot of one-on-one communication with various campers within our community. We call everyone who uses Free Code Camp a camper. And I definitely feel like teacher is probably the best way to describe my role.
So what inspired you to start Free Code Camp?
I wanted to make sure that other people didn't have to learn to code the way that I learned, which was frankly like a really traumatizing kind of trial by fire. Basically, I sat down at my kitchen table and just enrolled in dozens of online courses on Coursera and edX and bought a bunch of books and just started going to town by myself. And I didn't have any real focus. I was all over the map. Whenever I encountered some difficulty, the grass would seem greener on the other side. So I'd switch frameworks or switch languages. And I really just thrashed for a long period of time. I mean, eventually I did learn to code. I did start winning hackathons, and then I got my first software engineering job, and later got a bunch of consulting work and things like that. But the process was so much more isolated and so much more circuitous than it needed to be. So Free Code Camp, I really wanted to create a community, first of all, because there are literally millions of people in the world learning to code. There's no reason why anybody should do it alone. I wanted a supportive community and also a really rigorous curriculum that you could follow from end to end to be able to go out and be job ready as a developer.
So when you think about your journey and how traumatizing it was, what was the central issue, right? Because you mentioned signing up for a bunch of different things, which honestly I think is a lot of fun. When I sign up for a bunch of things, I feel very accomplished, wrongly feeling accomplished. But, you know, there's one, just the, what is it called, decision paralysis of having so many different options. There's also, you know, what do you do when you hit a wall? Do you plunge through or do you, you know, look for different options? There's the loneliness factor. There's so many different things that can make learning to code hard. When you think about the hardest part of that journey and how you've solved that in Free Code Camp, what is that thing?
Well, I think so much of learning to code is just sticking with something and not flinching in the face of what I like to call the blank page. Like sooner or later, everybody is going to get to the point where they've gone through some tutorials and they have a basic general understanding of what they're trying to do, but they actually need to synthesize it into an app or an algorithm. And that's really the Rubicon, so to speak, the point at which you need to cross over and you need to believe in yourself. And if you have a supportive community that, like, hey, everybody's already gone through this, it's not a big deal, that's fine and dandy. But if you're all by yourself, it can seem like, how can anybody ever do this? And I definitely felt when I finally got into the workforce and I looked around at all the normal people around me, I really felt that they had, like, somehow repressed the trauma of learning the code, that they were all really sociopaths and were just extremely good at hiding it, because I couldn't understand how anybody had done it.
Hmm. So now that you are a software engineer and you're teaching other people, what helped you get through it to the point that you did it? You are a developer.
Yeah, well, I mean, a huge portion of learning to code, like I said, is just being gritty, just sticking with it. And I always tell campers to do two things. One thing is something that John Ryzik, who was on Code Newbie previously, he's just an awesome developer, the guy that created jQuery and is now working over at Khan Academy. John Ryzik wrote this excellent blog post that just says, write code every day. Don't take a day off. Just every single day, just sit down and force yourself to make some progress. The other thing I tell people to do is to hang out with other people who code, because hanging out with other people who code just boosts your morale. You learn a whole lot. You build connections that you're later going to use to be able to get a job. And it just makes learning code so much more fun. And if you're not feeling passionate about learning the code, you're going to burn out and you're going to give up.
I love that you call, or students call themselves, campers. Like, that's so, you know, it's a small thing, but it's so powerful because it creates this bond. You know, I'm a camper, you're a camper, we're all campers. Tell us about the role of community and that bonding and how you've made that such a central part of the learning experience at Free Code Camp.
We started with Free Code Camp. I mean, the chat room was really central. We day one, I had a very basic Node.js app that I built over the course of like 3 days. And I had a very skeletal curriculum that was mostly classes from Stanford, for example, and some of my own screencasts and projects and things that I wanted people to build. But that chat room was really central. And I knew that if we just kind of nurtured that chat room, if we could actually get people hanging out in there and communicating regularly, that we could kind of get a little bit of a critical mass and people would be interacting and sharing their feelings and helping one another with different things they got stuck on in the curriculum and pair programming. And pair programming was always like a really big focus of Free Code Camp, and it still is. So the community, Free Code Camp is a community. Like, we identify as an open source community. We're not a school. We're not a website. We are a community. And that is by far the most important thing about Free Code Camp, is the fact that there are thousands of people that are actively using it every day and hundreds of people that are contributing to the code base. And if you ask a question in the help chat rooms, in one of the help chat rooms, we have different ones for different categories of challenges, you're going to get an answer usually, and usually within a minute or two. I mean, it's amazing the sense of togetherness and desire to help one another that we've been able to foster at Free Code Camp. And the campers will always be number one in terms of priority, and everything we'll ever do will be with the best interests of campers at heart.
So I want to talk a little bit about the curriculum. You mentioned that the very first iteration was done in just a couple of days, and you, like a lot of people, a lot of organizations, you were kind of designing your curriculum based on existing resources. And I'm curious to hear how you picked that initial curriculum and where that curriculum is now.
Absolutely. We focused on Node.js and full stack JavaScript from day one. We didn't know at the time how big JavaScript would blow up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were certainly, like in San Francisco where we're based, like we certainly felt like the kind of the initial tremors of Node.js just exploding. But I don't know if anybody anticipated it becoming so ubiquitous. So we really lucked out choosing JavaScript, and it also really disposed us to being able to do everything right in the browser, which is maximally convenient. I mean, we don't have to take the code, the input, and like run it on the back end and then push the results back up. We can literally just run all the code in the browser. You could like unplug your laptop and just solve a challenge and still see if you can get all the tests to pass and stuff like that. So our choice of JavaScript was really important. And another thing that was really important is we wanted everything to be completely self-paced. We never used any MOOCs or other content, MOOCs, massive open online courses. We never used any MOOCs that were like cohorted, that involved you waiting around for it to start. We never used anything that cost any money. From day one, Free Code Camp set out to be completely self-paced, completely browser-based, and completely free.
So I remember seeing the free part of Free Code Camp, I think it was maybe a year ago, maybe more than that, and thinking, no way. There has to be a catch. This is probably the content marketing part where it's going to be free for a couple months and it's going to be like $1,000. But you've maintained the free part of Free Code Camp. Why is that?
We will always be free for campers. We're always going to be free for the nonprofits we help. I honestly believe that free is the way to go. People shouldn't have to pay for learning resources. Education wants to be free. And there are so many excellent resources out there that are already free and probably will always remain free. If you look at like Coursera, like MIT, Harvard, OnEdX, and a whole bunch of other schools are putting like their best content online for free. Khan Academy is a great free resource. Code.org is a great resource for children to learn to code. And these are all completely free. And there should be a really good free end-to-end JavaScript curriculum as well. So that we feel very strongly that Free Code Camp should always be free, not freemium, free. And we're never going to paywall and make you get a pro account or anything like that. It will always be completely free. That's one of our core beliefs. And I called Free Code Camp free because I wanted to like tie my hands, basically. Like, we're not going to change the name. We're not going to charge you.
Yeah, I feel like it's really hard to rebrand at this point. Too many people know who you are and what you do. So I want to expand a little bit on that statement, education wants to be free, which feels very profound. And given that you have an education background, I feel like that comes from a very sincere and a very deep place. Tell me a little bit about maybe your past or your history, or, you know, what is it that got you to the point where right now, in an economy where everyone is cashing in on people learning to code, you are very, very convinced and very assertive about Free Code Camp being and staying free?
Sure. There are things that keep me up late at night. And one of them is the notion that there are all these people out there that are, you know, that have kids, that have mortgages, that have jobs. Many people are underemployed, and they have all this debt. They've got student debt from going to college, and maybe they've got student debt from going to grad school. And a lot of these investments aren't paying off in terms of like helping them pay down their debt fast enough. And to me, I've always felt that education should be completely free. I mean, it's completely free in a lot of countries. You can go and get a college degree for free in a lot of European countries, and it's just kind of absorbed by the public. If you look at, education can be extremely cheap. The marginal cost of education can rapidly approach zero. And we've seen that with MOOCs. We've seen that with Coursera. We've seen that with Khan Academy. And we're seeing that with Free Code Camp. Basically, you can achieve such great scale with online education that you don't really need a charge. You can just have a few ways that you make some baseline amount of money. And you can focus on providing the platform. And people will step forward and provide the content for that platform, which is certainly happening with MOOCs. I think that entire degree programs, undergraduate degree programs, can be completely free. There's a program called You Now, which is a very innovative kind of community college like university here in the Bay Area. It's not it's not a community college. It's actually a four-year degree program, and it's an accredited institution. And it is profound how cheap they're making it. And the way they're making it so cheap is through leveraging the power of software to deliver instructional content.
So do you worry that by making something as valuable and life-changing as education free, that people will end up not valuing education as much?
No. I think the very worst that could happen, oh my gosh, we have all these people that are overeducated because they overconsumed education, or are like people are always going to value education because employers value education. And at the end of the day, people need to go out and get a job. I mean, you need to do what you need to do to be competitive in a free market economy. And the labor market is fairly competitive here in the U.S. And as we hopefully loosen immigration standards and allow more foreign talent into the U.S., hopefully we're going to become more competitive as a country, because we're not going to be insulated from all the insanely overeducated Indians and Chinese and Russians and Brazilians that are basically just waiting on our border for us to like let them in so they can earn a Western developed country wage.
Mm-hmm. So some of the examples that you brought up who do provide education for free with the MOOCs and, you know, edX and is it still called OpenCourseWare? I'm not sure if they've rebranded, but a lot of those offerings are able to be free in part because people are still paying MIT and Harvard and Stanford for their four-year degrees, right? They're still paying the hundreds of thousands of dollars. So they can make that happen. They can allow that. So when you think about sustainability for a free code camp, how do you think you'll manage long-term in keeping it running and keeping it as, you know, exciting and as awesome as it is if you're not going to charge?
So we are absolutely going to charge, but we're never going to charge our campers. We're never going to charge the nonprofits. You may be aware of this, but there is an insatiable demand for software engineering talent right now. And employers are paying, you know, recruiters 33 cents on the dollar of a first year salary to get software engineers in the door at their companies. I mean, there's just there are tremendous margins in recruiting. And we think that by helping campers get jobs at employers, our interests are aligned with the interests of the camper. I mean, they want to go out and get a job, and that we can make more than enough money off of helping facilitate that. Right now we're getting ready to launch a job board, and it's actually a really unique job board. Basically, FreeCodeCamp offers two different certifications along the way to completing the program. Let me just kind of step back and tell you a little bit about the program itself. So the first 400 hours of FreeCodeCamp is building a bunch of front-end development projects. And at the end of that 400 hours, you get a front-end development certification. It's a verifiable certification. Like anybody who has that certification can like follow the URL through and verify that you've actually earned it. And the only way to fake it would be to like gain production access to our databases, to gain access to our production databases. So people aren't going to be able to fake that. It's like super verified. And we also do, you know, code review, and we have a very strict academic honesty policy and everything like that. So you can earn that certification. We also, the next 400 hours focuses on full stack JavaScript and using Node.js, using Express, using databases, and either Angular, or we're switching to React.js. And then you'll earn the full stack development certification. So that's 800 hours worth of coursework, essentially, that you have like this suite of apps that you've created. You'll create like 15 apps just in the course of finishing that first 800 hours. If you have those certifications, then you'll be able to apply for the jobs that are on our job board. So that's kind of like the twist of our job board. It's verified. Only campers who've completed those certifications can apply for the jobs, and employers can easily just go in and look and see the live work, because everything you do on FreeCodeCamp is completely transparent. Everybody has a code portfolio. Every project he or she has ever submitted is just right there, and you can browse the source on GitHub, or you can look at the live app running on Heroku or on CodePen.
Wow. So as a camper who did not complete the 800 hours, can they even see the job board and what's posted?
Sure, they can see the jobs that are posted, but they can't actually apply for them.
They can't apply for them.
We like obscure the actual application instructions. So it might be like email so-and-so or call so-and-so. But like that is good for the employers as well as the campers, I think. Like I think we found like a really win-win situation because employers don't want to be inundated with like resumes for unqualified people. It's just an onerous task to try to go through and like find the proverbial diamonds in the rough and suffer, you know, figure out who's actually good at coding and who's just spamming the resume out. So this way they get very few applications relative to what they would get if they were to just post it on like a huge job board. But
they're high quality.
Those applications are like serious people that are worth actually looking into. And the campers themselves get to see what kind of work they would potentially be doing when they complete Free Code Camp. And they can kind of see the finish line, so to speak, which the finish line and everybody's like 90% of people who use Free Code Camp do want to get a software engineering job. The other 10% already have a software engineering job or something like that. And they just want to get promoted within their current position. Like we get a lot of Java engineers and people like that that are trying to learn cutting edge skills like Node.js and React.
So one of the biggest problems with the, you know, the MOOCs and a lot of the online courses is that people don't finish, right? They sign up to 50 like you did way back when. They get really excited about it. They'll do a couple lectures. But I think it's, 5%, less than 5% people actually finish it. So what does that completion rate look like for Free Code Camp? Do you find a lot of people getting most of the way through?
So our attrition rate is practically identical to the attrition rate of, you know, a hard Coursera or edX course. And actually, one of my personal heroes, the founder of Coursera, Daphne Koller, she has basically done her best to go out and educate the general public that, like, actually these attrition rates are a very good thing because they're open, literally anybody and their dog can sign up to take, you know, Stanford's algorithm class, for example, which is a very popular one. And that's a profoundly good thing because I can just casually go in and sign up for it and never even show up. And I like if you actually look at the people who complete like some specific milestone within the courses, generally they have a much higher completion rate. It jumps to like 50 or 60%. But a majority of people never even turn in the first homework assignment. And that's very similar with Free Code Camp. Like we have more than 100,000 people use Free Code Camp every month. And it's like 200,000 or 300,000 people. And like majority of those people never even create an account. They just go and like use it for reference or they play around with like a specific technology on Free Code Camp. That's totally cool. We are not judging ourselves by the number of people who try Free Code Camp and don't make it through. We're judging ourselves by the volume of people that actually do really dig into Free Code Camp and use it a lot.
So what does success look like? You know, at the end of the day, when you think back to, you've been working on Free Code Camp for what, about a year? A little more than that?
Yeah, almost 13 months.
Almost 13 months. Wow. Yeah. So when you look back at that and you think about your progress and where you want Free Code Camp to go for the camper, what does success look like?
Success for us looks like people learning and having fun and engaging with code. And then at the end of that process, getting a software engineering job and continuing to use Free Code Camp. Like a lot of people have gotten jobs and they continue to hang out in Free Code Camp and expand the curriculum and help other campers in the help chat and build cool apps that are like standalone apps that we can potentially use in our kind of ecosystem of various like Free Code Camp apps. Like somebody built a really cool leaderboard, for example, that's like weighted and everything, and people can go see how they compare to all the other campers, things that we ourselves haven't had time to build out. So one metric that I think is a really good indication of the usefulness of Free Code Camp, because I firmly believe that use connotes usefulness. In the last 30 days, campers have used FreeCoke Camp for a total of 5 million minutes.
Wow. That's a big number.
It is. And so far, I think they've completed more than 6 million total challenges on FreeCoke Camp since we started tracking that a few months ago.
That's intense. Congratulations.
Thank you. We've been like super lucky. I think we really were in the right place at the right time. There was like clearly demand for a more community approach, a more peer learning approach, as opposed to like a more regimented, cohorted, in-person type approach. I think those are extremely valuable as well. But it's clear that like most of the people who use FreeCoke Camp are in their 30s and have kids and have jobs and are doing this at night after the kids go to bed.
Mm-hmm. So I imagine that there were many iterations of the product, or at least parts of the product, in the last 13 months. I'm curious to hear, what are some things that you tried that worked really well in terms of helping people learn, and what are some things that didn't work out so well?
One of the things that we tried that didn't work out very well at all was we actually had like this asynchronous forum, and our hope was people would go there and build out like more long form communication and stuff. And what we found is people really do prefer synchronous communication. People really do prefer like saying something or asking a question and getting a response immediately. So we have shifted pretty much all of FreeCoke Camp to be very real time in philosophy. So one of the things we do a whole lot is we stream on Twitch, and we do live coding on Twitch several times a week. Anybody who's in the FreeCoke Camp community that wants to hop on and stream can do so. The woman who's in charge of our Twitch streaming, her name is Brianna Swift. She's actually done a great job of kind of evangelizing the whole notion of streaming coding. She wrote a blog post recently, which is on our Medium, that is titled 7 Ways That Streaming Makes You a Better Coder. And one of the things she points out in there is that it's basically like, it's like pair program with a huge number of people at the same time. Because if you're streaming on FreeCoke Camp, you could have like 20 or 30 people watching and chatting with you and giving you feedback and saying, oh, you forgot that proverbial semicolon. So that's been extremely effective. Some other things that we thought might be a huge hit, but weren't. People really don't like videos that much.
Really?
We started with a lot of video content. Yeah, Khan Academy, actually. Pamela Fox with Khan Academy, I was talking to her, and she said, yeah, people are moving away from video toward more interactive. And it makes total sense. I mean,
no, I hate videos, but I always thought I was the only one.
The tighter the feedback loop, the better, really. And a video is a very loose feedback loop because, I mean, you're watching and you're doing it on your own. And, you know, some platforms have like these cool, like kind of comprehension checks built in. And I think those are good. But if you can do away with the videos and just have people coding the entire time, that's even better. So that's been a direction we've been going in for a while. We like removed virtually all the videos from FreeCoke Camp's curriculum. We replaced some of them with like these short GIFs. And it's like a step-by-step here. Watch this GIF. Like, one great thing about video that a lot of people don't think about is like, you can rock out to whatever music you want. You don't have to stop your music and like listen to some you know, 35-year-old guy in his closet drone on about like how to get onto FreeCoke Camp's chat room, for example.
That is true. So you mentioned earlier that you decided to teach Node.js, but when you didn't quite know that JavaScript was going to be that popular or Node.js was going to be that popular. What made you decide to pick JavaScript over other languages?
Sure. So I am a former Rails developer. I love Ruby on Rails, and I really enjoyed building a lot of apps in Ruby on Rails. I even built a prototype for FreeCoke Camp in Ruby on Rails a couple days before I built the Node one. And it just became clear, like, I'm here in San Francisco, and I like to say this is the mecca of software engineering and the mecca of technology innovation. And every hackathon you went to, everybody was using Node. Like, every like major companies were shifting to Node, like Netflix, PayPal, Microsoft. They have .NET, and they still use Node extensively now. LinkedIn moved to Node. So it was clear that Node was a thing, so to speak, and it was being adopted much more rapidly than Django for Python or Rails. Rails is still used in a lot of production apps like GitHub, but Node is just being adopted insanely quickly. So at that point, all my friends who were developers were like, yeah, we're switching to Node. And they weren't getting their fingers burned. They really loved it. So I decided, hey, let's focus on Node. I mean, I don't know Node nearly as well as I know Rails, but the saying is, like, if you're climbing mountains and your goal is to get to the highest point you can, you get like halfway up one mountain and you look over and you see a taller mountain, you climb down that mountain and you climb up the taller mountain, right? I mean, that's the rational thing to do, and that was what I ended up doing, and it was definitely the right call in retrospect.
So for Node, what was it that made it so popular? Did something happen that propelled that to the point where everyone you know was switching over to Node?
Well, one thing, I mean, there are several trends here that are making Node so popular. One thing is everybody already knows JavaScript. You can't be a web developer without JavaScript. Even if you're like a back-end developer at some point, you're going to have to deal with like JSON APIs and stuff like that and get some exposure to JavaScript probably. So the fact that everybody already knows some JavaScript, nope, there were very few people that knew it well, but everybody was like, we like to call dangerous with JavaScript.
Such an overused word. But so true, yep.
Yeah, everybody knows how to break things using JavaScript.
That's what that means.
So we decided like, hey, that if it's possible now, thanks to Node.js, that we can have essentially full stack JavaScript. We've even got these databases like MongoDB and RethinkDB, and you can like query them and write everything you need in pure JavaScript. You never need to touch SQL again if you don't want to. It became clear that like people are going to have to learn a lot more JavaScript anyway, because the front end is getting more and more complicated. A lot of people don't realize this, but the front end is just exploding in difficulty, and there are so many jobs in front end development now. And like, I'd probably say most full stack developers spend a lot more time on the front end than the back end,
oh, wow.
at least with JavaScript now that you've got like more complicated client side development tools like React and Angular. So that was one big thing, the role of full stack JavaScript. And the other thing is just the insane performance of Node.js. I mean, it is literally some number of times faster than Rails or Django or PHP Laravel. I mean, it's just like extremely fast. Walmart, when they first switched to Node, they did it on Black Friday and they had 300 million users.
Wow.
I mean, it's just insane, right? Like you can only get 300 million users if you're Walmart. And you have like literally millions of users in China and millions of users in Russia and Brazil and all these other major countries. But they did. They had like 300 million concurrent users, and they switched everything over to Node, and their CPU never broke 1%. Like it never went above 1%.
Wow.
And they served all those people. Like,
wow.
I mean, other companies like were able to take like, I can't remember who it was. Like LinkedIn or somebody like that, they basically they had like 30 servers, right, that were running this app in Java, and they rewrote it in Node, and like it took like a few developers to rewrite it in Node. Before it was just this horrendously large Java application, and it ended up only needing like one or two of those 30 servers to serve the same number of people. So it's just extremely economical and high performance. That's another reason why Node.js is blowing up. And the third reason why Node is becoming so popular is NPM. NPM used to stand for Node Package Manager. It's an empty acronym now. But basically, NPM is the largest software open source package ecosystem in human history. Like it's substantially larger than wow. RubyGems or Python's packages or any of these other languages. And you literally have tools for practically everything. And it's so easy because NPM is such a clever well-engineered package management system. It's just very easy to like manage dependencies and create just a very lightweight package to deal with a very specific use case.
So you built the free CodeCamp website in Node?
Correct. I used a boilerplate. This is like a theme that I'll touch on probably repeatedly throughout my career, is standing on the shoulders of giants. I did not attempt to build an app from like scratch. I used this tool called the Hackathon Starter, which was basically a boilerplate. It already had authentication built in through Passport.js. I already had like Mongoose wired in, which is a popular object relational mapper tool for interacting with your database. And of course it had like Mongo and everything was configured. So basically it made it very easy for me to deploy a dynamic website with Node.js and Express.js. And I was able to build it in like 3 days.
Wow. So you were a Rails guy, and then you picked Node.js, you built the Node.js, you know, the free code camp app using Node.js, and on free code camp, you are teaching Node.js.
That's correct. We eat our own dog food.
So how much of what you've built was learned? It feels like you kind of had to learn everything on the go as you're teaching it and as you're building it.
That was profoundly useful because I knew exactly what resources were good and what weren't, and what kind of blind alleys not to go down. And like I was intimately familiar with the complexities of using, you know, a synchronous tool. Like JavaScript is different from a lot of these other scripting languages in that like you don't lock things down when you're accessing the database. Your script could be trying to access the database multiple times concurrently and weird stuff can happen. So you have to get used to that. And then like the major popular way of going about coding in JavaScript is using functional programming, which is quite different from object-oriented programming, which is what I used extensively when I was doing Rails. So there was a lot to learn.
How do you feel about that switch from object-oriented to functional?
I mean, I'm still trying to wrap my head around everything. I always tell people learning the code is very hard. And sure, you can go out and get a job in like 9 months or a year of self-studying, but you're going to be learning stuff and you're going to feel like a fool for the rest of your career. That doesn't go away.
So I think there's so much value in teaching someone right after you've learned it, right? Because you can put yourself in their shoes. You can really understand the pain points and, you know, you remember how it feels. Do you ever feel like you're at a disadvantage that you don't have, you know, years of experience, if that's even a thing, you know, in Node, and you're teaching it relatively soon after learning it yourself?
Well, the great thing about Node is it's pretty new. I mean, it's been around for like 4 years, I think, and there are very few experts in Node.js. I mean, most of them work at Netflix and a couple key companies. A lot of what's being developed, like JavaScript, just moves so fast that, yes, absolutely, if you have a strong computer science and software engineering theoretical background, you will be able to learn this stuff a lot faster and it'll make a lot more sense and you'll be able to make a lot more connections in your mind. But really, everybody has to sit down and learn this stuff. And most of these tools are pretty darn new. So, yeah, it's a little bit of a disadvantage, but it's not anything that can't be overcome through effort and ingenuity.
So I want to go back to the number of people who actually complete Free Code Camp. So after you do the 800 hours, the last few steps, if I'm remembering this correctly, are that you get to actually work on a nonprofit project. Is that right?
That's correct. The first half of Free Code Camp's curriculum is actually like building projects in kind of a controlled environment. Like we do have some, we call them waypoints, which are kind of like more traditional interactive code editor things where you're like trying to solve exactly one thing and progress beyond that. And then we have just a ton of projects. We have bonfires, which are algorithm challenges very similar to what you'd see on like Project Euler, for example, except not quite as mathematically demanding. And then we have zip lines, which are front-end development challenges where you build single-page applications, mostly using jQuery and JavaScript HTML5. And then we have base jumps, which are the full stack challenges that involve using Node, Express, and then Angular, React, and MongoDB, and deploying all that stuff to Heroku and getting it up on GitHub and everything. And after you complete all of that, that first 800 hours, then we have 800 more hours of real projects that you do for nonprofits. So the way these work is after you've completed the first 800 hours, you have a full stack development certification and you qualify to do these projects. So you jump into a special chat room that's just for people who already have their full stack development certifications, and you coordinate with other people and you find somebody you like and you buddy up. And then we match you with a nonprofit. We have just dozens of nonprofits that are like in line to have us help build projects for them. And you can choose one. And if it looks like a good fit, we will also get a stakeholder from that nonprofit who's agreed to kind of like serve as
the PM.
Yeah, exactly. The product manager and represent the business interest. And then we also have agile project managers who serve as kind of like the logistical coordination and help plan the sprints and everything. And then we use extreme programming. And over the course of the next few weeks, we build out that solution. And then we deploy that solution to the cloud and it runs in production and it serves to help the nonprofit more efficiently accomplish its goals and serve its mission.
That's so, so awesome. What is it like for you and for the campers to finally see their work in the real world, you know, in live production, helping people on their different missions?
I can't really describe it in words. I mean, I've deployed a lot of apps for production and I've gotten things accepted into projects and pushed. It's a great feeling to see your code running, because at the end of the day, what does every single programmer want? Their code to be used by people. They want their code to be useful. So seeing that a nonprofit has basically just shaved $100,000 worth of administrative costs off of its annual IT expenses, or that it's just made things extremely easy for donors to give them money, or that they now have a much easier way for the people out in the field to be able to accomplish their goal. I'll just walk you through a project real quick. So
yeah.
Christian Barros, he is originally from Chile, and he was on a project with Alexander Black, and they were working on for a nonprofit called Copernic. And Copernic is like an initiative that helps women in rural Indonesia kind of become micro entrepreneurs. So they sell sustainable goods such as solar powered flashlights and water filters, other kind of developmental products that like have this massive kind of low hanging fruit effect of making people's lives substantially better without spending a lot of money. And these women in rural Indonesia basically buy these at a discount, like below cost. And then they go out and sell them to their neighbors. So it kind of stimulates their local economy and inspires entrepreneurialism within these women. And it makes the community substantially safer and a healthier place to be. So they have all these women out there that are trying to, you know, track their sales and inventory using pen and paper and stuff. And Chris and Alex, Chris is really great. And together they built this, it's like a Chrome application. Basically, it's pure JavaScript. It runs in the browser and it can be completely disconnected from the internet and still run and still store things. And it'll run on an iPad, for example, or on like a commodity kind of cheap tablet that costs $100. So now the women out in Indonesia don't have to keep track of all this paper and do all this weird data entry, and they've got form validation, they've got everything. And then as soon as a connection to the internet is reestablished, it just pushes all the data up to Copernic servers. So it's just like bam, we just saved so many people so much hassle, and probably substantially increased the validity of their reporting and things like that. And all because Christian Barros and Alexander Black, Christian Barros got an H-1B visa and like moved to the U.S. and lives in Austin. He works for Headspring now. Basically, they were able to do that, and they just made a substantial difference. And it was all just, it all just came together. You know, the stakeholder really wanted it. And Michael Johnson, who's our nonprofit guy in Washington, D.C., he coordinated that project, and I was involved in the project day to day. And I mean, I think I literally like closed my laptop at the end of the meeting after we pushed everything live, and I just cried. Oh. I mean, I was like extremely moved by the fact that I'd played even a small role in getting this code out there.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's absolutely wonderful. It's so great when you can take something as powerful as code and you can apply it to something very good, right? Very objectively good. So that's wonderful that you get to do that, and you get to help other people do that.
And Saran, there are so many opportunities out there. There are so many Copernics and so many other organizations that are doing things the old-fashioned way that really would benefit from being empowered by pro bono code.
Yes.
We're not going to run out of nonprofits to help, like ever. Like, so even if you complete all four of the projects, we're still going to, if you want to come back and keep completing these projects, you're welcome to, because it's not that much work to administer. I mean, it is a lot of work. Like, we have volunteer project managers from the, we partnered with the PMP, the Project Management Institute, PMI, and they're PMPACP, Agile Project Managers. And they actually do a lot of the grunt work in terms of like making sure the project moves forward and scheduling and everything like that. But we've kind of come up with this system where it is pretty sustainable and pretty scalable to get campers working on this. And we just have to constantly refine and improve the way we go about it. But it's just such a thrill. I mean, that's definitely the most thrilling thing we do.
Yeah.
Is do these nonprofit projects. And they are definitely like, I'm super thrilled that we lucked out and like figured out that this would actually work. Nobody thought it would actually work. I talked to a lot of people from nonprofits that basically help with technology and stuff. And they had all these reasons why it probably wouldn't work. But they had all these great lessons that we learned from them, and we were able to incorporate those and we were able to figure out a way to make it work. It's still, I mean, there are still, you know, little things that happen. Like one of our projects, like the stakeholder just kind of had like this weird thing, and we just open sourced it. We got his permission and we open sourced the project. But like all the other projects we've done, I think 16 of them have like gone through, you know, and they were successful.
So when you think about the campers who completed the course and completed the curriculum, got to the point where they were contributing code to real projects, what was their secret? What was the thing that helped them get to the finish line that'd be helpful for some of our listeners to know?
Sure. Well, those two things I mentioned earlier, they definitely coded every day. You can look at their activity kind of heat map on FreeCodeCamp. Like, they were very active on FreeCodeCamp, and it wasn't just like a casual thing. A lot of them had full-time jobs and kids and things like that, but they figured out a way to work FreeCodeCamp into their routine. And they were also very active within the community. Like, everybody knew who they were because they were in the chat room, and they were on Twitch streaming things, and they were sharing like the different projects they built frequently on Twitter and Facebook. And now we have these local communities in all of our cities, and they were very active in those as well. So it was like, just, it was clear that they put a lot of time and energy into it. I think time, energy, enthusiasm, that makes up for so much, even if you don't feel like you're the smartest person. And a lot of people mistakenly think they're not going to be able to code because they're quote unquote bad at math and things like that. In fact, they'd probably be really good if they just sat down and practiced. I mean, the Chinese are amazing at math. And if you look at how much they do math, they literally do, you know, math 3 or 4 hours a day when they're in high school. So it's just practice makes perfect. There's not really any big secret. And then the socialization.
So you've been working on Free Code Camp for the last 13 months. Is that your basically your full-time job at this point?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is not merely my full-time job. Like, this is what I plan to do for the rest of my life.
Wow. That's big.
You know, Saran, I love this. I can give you kind of an idea of my day to day if you're curious, like what my life is like now that I'm involved with Free Code Camp.
Yeah, I'd love to know.
So I wake up, I like literally jump out of bed. Of course, I've got a newborn, so I'm usually jumping out of bed to go change a diaper. And then I run over to my computer and hop on and just I spend like 4 hours or so just responding to messages and emails. I do all of our support myself. A lot of people are like, why do you do support? Just contract that out to somebody, pay somebody. But it, like, I strongly believe that support is the most important role within an organization because you're very close to the campers.
Yes.
Like you're constantly, like if there's a pain point, if something's broken or if something's annoying, you will know about it before anybody else. And then I can go into our stand-up meetings and say, hey, Berkeley Martinez, he's our main code base maintainer, and he does a whole lot of work in terms of managing like the huge influx of volunteer contributions to our code base. I can be like, hey, Berkeley, we really need to bump this to a priority because I've heard 3 reports of it in the last 24 hours. And so being close to the campers and interacting closely with them just gives me this deep sense of what's going on. And it's like 4 hours of my day. Like that's 4 hours I can't spend coding to make Free Code Camp better. But it's really important to being able to understand what is going on within the community. And that's our utmost concern, is making sure that everybody's getting the most out of Free Code Camp as a community. And so I answer emails. I do all the tweets on Twitter. I am actually on Facebook. Free Code Camp has more than 500 different cities that we have local chapters in now.
Oh, wow.
And I'm active in all those. And if people like mention me or ask questions, I'm like quick to jump in and answer. And then we use Gitter, which is basically like Slack, but it's for open source teams. And they just have an incredible team out of London. And they're like, they're just building it so fast and building out so many critical features. So I spend like a lot of time in there, and like all of our team uses Gitter to communicate. By the way, everything we do on Gitter is completely public. Everything we do on GitHub is completely public. Like we live in public. I really do believe in transparency. You know, Buffer is this company that like literally tells everybody everything about their plans, and it's great. I love that. I'm not so fond of like the Snapchats of the world that are like, we need to keep everything secret, or the Apples of the world, like, you'll see it when we're ready. We're not going to even tell our own people what we're doing. Like, it's seriously demoralizing. Like, just, I mean, come on. Yeah, you're going to sacrifice some of the big wham bang punch, but like, nobody should ever be surprised when Free Code Camp pushes a feature. Like, it should have had like dozens of issues and failing branches and everything like that before it ever makes it to production. So yeah, like basically by staying close to the campers and by being really transparent, people approach us and they tell us when things are wrong. We have a bug button right on every page of Free Code Camp that you click it and it like pre-populates a GitHub issue and you can just submit it. And that's like an issue that we have issue moderators that are volunteers that are going to go through and groom that issue and see if it's something they can reproduce and ask you questions and start a dialogue and then move that over to a timeline to when we're going to have a pull request for it. So it's like the community being super transparent and super communicative and like being able to Google phrases, like everything we do on Gitter gets indexed by Google. So a lot of people like stumble upon different things that we've had, different issues that our open source community has had and that can solve some of their problems.
So how big is your team? Because it sounds like there's a lot of things going on, a lot of people helping out.
Yeah, I can tell you that the core team is really me, Quincy Larson here in San Francisco, and I do the support and a lot of the project management type stuff. And then I do feature development too. I code like probably 4 to 8 hours a day. And then Berkeley Martinez, who's also here in San Francisco, he is just the coolest guy. I kept bumping into him at hackathons. He was very, very memorable because he always wore a bow tie and suspenders and carries this huge leather briefcase.
Smart.
And his leather briefcase has like his MacBook, and he has these paperback copies of, like, you know, Robert Heinlein novels that he reads when he's on the BART, which is the train system here in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And then he is basically like our CTO. I mean, he is accountable. He owns the code base in terms of making sure that things work, and he owns the infrastructure, making sure that servers don't break and that everything's fast. And then Michael Johnson is in Washington, D.C. He's our nonprofit guy, and he also does a lot of just general camper outreach and tries to understand the needs of our campers. And then we also have Brianna, whom I mentioned earlier. She's a music teacher from she's an elementary school music teacher from Champaign, Urbana, Illinois. And she is in charge of Twitch TV and like our channel there and a lot of our streaming efforts. And she also is recording a whiteboard kind of explanation style series of videos that cover computer science and software engineering theory. And they're just these 3-minute little videos that have comprehension check questions, very similar to like MOOCs that you would see on Coursera or edX. And they're just these bite-sized lessons that we're going to put on Free Code Camp soon. They're going to be called hikes.
Neat.
And then we have Wesley, who is in charge of streaming as well. He's kind of with Brianna, and they have kind of this new podcast thing. We just call it a campfire. It's like a live stream. It's very casual, and they just talk to different people from within the community, and they record it and then they edit it into a podcast, and that's going to start happening more regularly. And he is currently bicycling from Tampa Bay to Colorado, so he might very well be on the road. Hopefully he'll listen to this while he's on his bike. We have a ton of other people. Nathan Lenniz, who's literally in the Army bomb squad. Like, he disassembles bombs all day long. That's his day job. And then he comes home and unwinds by contributing to Free Code Camp's code base. And on top of coding, or on top of working 40 hours, he probably codes an extra 40 hours. In fact, like New Year's Eve last year, he was in Korea after doing a day on the bomb squad. And we hopped on, and I didn't even realize New Year's had come and gone because I was so impressed and like stunned at this guy, like this epic pair programming session.
Wow.
I mean, we have so many other people that I could talk about. Rafael Rodriguez in the Bronx. He's a single dad. He's really cool, and he does our wiki. Like, he's basically in charge of building our wiki, which is now almost 500 entries. We have Arson. He's in Armenia, and he's helping with like monitor and vet PRs and stuff like that, pull requests. We have Anirudh Agarwal, who's in Singapore. And he's also helping with issue moderation. So it's just like a huge team effort. Ryan Malm is a designer from Omaha. He did our logo and like a lot of our assets. And he's just a graphic designer and a family man in Omaha. But he was one of our first coders, our first campers on Free Code Camp. Like, day one, when I was sitting in the chat room with my wife trying to make it look busy, and and like, he showed up and I was able to get him to actually stick around by talking about you know, Conway's Game of Life. So so different little things like that, like, yeah, that we've gradually kind of accumulated these incredible people that from all kinds of different backgrounds. Like, you wouldn't expect a music teacher at an elementary school in Champaign, Urbana to know a whole lot about computer science and software engineering, but she does because she spends all her time reading about it, and she's an excellent teacher, and she can really communicate this just, you know, as well as Salman Khan can communicate in his Khan Academy videos. So it's just really tremendous that these people are interested in helping out and volunteering with Free Code Camp.
So knowing everything you know about teaching and your, you know, in the past being a, was it a school director?
Yes.
Is that the name? Yes. Being a school director, being in education for a long time, and then now having done Free Code Camp for 13 months so far and hoping to do it for a lifetime. What are some lessons, some takeaways that you've learned about the learning process that you're surprised by or just didn't expect?
One thing that really surprised me, you know, there's all this talk in education about gamification, basically making learning more like a game or making things that aren't games more like games is what gamification is. I was really surprised by how effective even extremely rudimentary, simple gamification can be in terms of getting people to come back and keep learning and really enjoy learning a whole lot more. I went to a talk by Jeff Atwood, and I talked to him afterward and told him a little bit about Free Code Camp. I told him about our brownie points system. Everything's camper themed, so we were like, okay, brownie points, great. So it's basically this little number that ticks up every time you complete a challenge or every time you help somebody in chat. We have CamperBot in our Gitter chat room system. And if you do thank and then their at handle, it'll give them a brownie point. So we just have that really simple brownie point system. And it's amazing. Like Jeff Atwood said, you need to be extremely careful when you put a number beside somebody's name, because it's human nature to do whatever you can to make that number go up.
Ooh.
And that was very profound. So it was with great responsibility. We didn't want to encourage any sort of behavior that we thought could be deleterious to their learning or could potentially be abused. Because like there's a lot of emotion attached to that. Like people get like a multi-day streak. Like one camper had like literally like a 3-month streak or something like that.
Wow.
Because he got brownie points every single day. And it was really impressive. But like when you create those very basic gamification mechanisms, it's amazing how even a simple thing, like people are geeking out about badges and all these other stuff. And I'm sure that stuff works great. But just having a streak and just having a very simple number that represents your score is so powerful. A famous quote from Napoleon, which I've always loved, is something like, I'm going to butcher this, but men will go to great lengths and give up their lives for tiny bits of ribbon.
Wow. Yeah, I like that.
So that was something that like, you hear gamification is effective. We should use gamification more in K-12. I could not agree more with that sentiment. Gamification is incredible.
Interesting. Very cool. So next, let's move on to some rapid fire fill in the blanks. Are you ready?
Yeah, absolutely.
Number one, worst advice I've ever received is?
Stick with what you're good at.
Tell me about that.
So when I first decided I wanted to learn to code, I had lots of friends who were, you know, traditionally trained software engineers at places like Oracle and Microsoft. And I think it was at like a dinner party or something. And I just casually said like, yeah, I want to learn to code and do what you guys are doing. That sounds awesome. And their knee jerk reaction was, whoa, cowboy, stick with what you're good at. Like you're a pretty good school director. You're doing a good job. There's no need for you to turn your life on its ear and try to like basically go and learn to code. Like it's this ocean of knowledge and you're going to drown. You're going to go crazy before you learn to code. That was basically what they said to me. And, you know, they had masters in computer science and years of experience at big enterprise companies. And I can understand how they thought that it would be unlikely that some 30-year-old dude would be able to just sit down by himself and like absorb all this content. And to be fair, I've only absorbed a small percentage of it, but I've absorbed like some of the important stuff. So obviously I didn't listen to that advice. I sat down and grinded through it. And, you know, if I had listened to that advice, if I just, you know, heeded the stick with what you're good at, you know, I'd be a school director. I would be running a school of about 100 students like I was before, but I didn't listen to that. And instead I'm kind of like a school director, except now my school is more than 100,000 students.
Was it hard to ignore that advice?
Yes. every time I got in a situation that was stressful. I mean, you had a great guest talk about imposter syndrome a couple weeks ago, and even though I am like a white male who's, you know, of the typical software engineer age, like early 30s, I felt so much imposter syndrome when I was going to like hackathons and even hanging out at hackerspaces. Like everybody knew about Arduino. Everybody had like, you know, all these cloud servers and all these cron jobs running tasks for them. And it was like they were wizards and I was a muggle or something. I mean, it was just insanely stressful. So I definitely kept that kept echoing in my mind. Stick with what you're good at. And another thing I'll say, I always felt because I was good at other things that it was okay for me to be a mediocre software engineer. That like for example, I lived in China for 5 years and I used to work as an interpreter, and just spent like tens of thousands of hours speaking Chinese, right? And like I would always be like, well, I'm not stupid because I learned Chinese, so it's okay for me to kind of suck at coding. And like I would do all these things, but like, do yourself a favor, do not fall back on previous accomplishments. Mm-hmm. Because only after you like burn the proverbial boats at the shore and say, look I'm gonna become a software engineer, I really don't care about this past life, this stranger, right? This is me now. And I'm this person that desperately needs to learn to code to move forward. Like if you can do that, if you can cut out all of your history and all of your, you know, safety lines and everything you like resort to like beef up your ego, if you can do that and truly focus on learning to code, you'll be so much better off than I was. And I know people who did that and they just kind of like, you know, just cut it out and just focused on the task at hand, and they always do so much better than people like me that were constantly doubting themselves.
Do you still doubt yourself?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think even really experienced software engineers, like if you have a classical education, like you know, computer science has been around for all of like 50 or 60 years, but if you went to like Stanford and you have like a PhD in computer science, for example, like I know a few people like that. I'm sure you doubt yourself a lot less because you can always say like, oh, but I went to Stanford, I must know this stuff. Or if you've like had great success in terms of like, if you invented BitTorrent or if you invented Bitcoin or something like that, some profound technology that's changed everything, then I can imagine you being able to not doubt yourself as much. But I know a ton of people who code that are constantly doubting themselves, even at the highest levels of the profession. You're going to feel like a fool and you need to be ready to get through that.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Wait, so how long have you been coding total?
4 years. I started right before I left my school director job. And then I coded on my own for about 5 or 6 months, where I was just living off of savings and, you know, basically just cranking through MOOCs and textbooks and stuff. And then I eventually got a coding job, and yeah, the rest is history. But basically 4 years. So really I'm like very new. I mean, if you look at like the timeline of how long it really takes to become a good coder, it's a long time. It's probably a decade or more. I mean, it's just like any deep craft. You're not going to become like an expert chess player in a few years. You're going to need to put in the time. And so I'm still putting in the time.
Yep. Number two, my first coding project was about?
So as I've said, and as you probably already understand from listening to this, thanks for sticking with us. I love MOOCs. I love massive open online courses. I love the fact that I can sit down at my leisure and learn virtually any topic I want from some of the greatest minds in the field. You know, if you want to learn Scala, the guy who created Scala has a Scala MOOC. So I wanted to create a recommendation engine that would basically help you build a curriculum of MOOCs custom to you.
And nice.
Basically, you would just authenticate with LinkedIn. It would look at your profile, figure out what skills you currently have. It would ask you, what field do you want to go into? So let's say that you wanted to go into data science. Well, if you... basically, if you've already got a certain amount of skills, we can not show you certain courses, but but we'll build up a sequence of courses, and then you can start working through them, and eventually you'll have the skills that you need to start applying for a data science job, right? It like works perfectly in theory. And actually, I wrote a whole bunch of algorithms and scraped all these sites and like wrote these algorithms to go through and figure out and actually crunch things in terms of like when was a course available. I mean, all kinds of like difficult engineering stuff. I learned a ton. Anyway, like all these academics were like, oh man, this is going to be amazing. I can't wait to use this. And of course, like I finally finished after like 2,000 or 3,000 hours of work and I shipped it and like it was freaking crickets. Like nobody cared. Nobody even used it. I think some people like use it. It was probably my mom pretending to be somebody else. You know,
it's a good mom.
And like I was like, oh man, like doing the postmortem, like this is obviously a failure. I think what it was you know, you have to spend hundreds of hours like working through these MOOCs, and they're hard. Yeah. And I mean, would you trust an algorithm to like in a few seconds determine like an entire curriculum for you to like to guide your career? I think that's the problem.
It's a big responsibility. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Number three, one thing I wish I knew when I first started to code is
you need to focus. You absolutely need to focus or you will drown. There is just so much out there to learn if you want to learn to code. Like, there are a million different languages. There are a million different frameworks. If you spend a lot of time on Hacker News, news.ycombinator.com, if you spend a lot of time there, you're just going to see all these amazing projects and all these overhyped tools that don't pan out, like Famous, for example, the big JavaScript library. Like that, I think that might be abandonware now, but I know so many people who sank so much time into learning how to do that. You know, like there are a few key things that you really need to learn. The main thing is you just need to learn coding really well. Like, what is the job of a software engineer? Well, half of it is writing code and half of it is probably maintaining code, like in a large legacy code base. And what do those two things have in common? They are coding. So I see a lot of people get distracted with like, oh, this editor is better than that editor, or like, oh, you really should install Arch Linux instead of Ubuntu, or, you know, whatever. I mean, I see so much distraction, like, oh, you know, let's deploy the servers with Docker. Yeah, we'll do that. Like, come on, we're trying to code here. Like, you're not going to get to be an awesome coder unless you sit down and code. So you need to focus one language, one framework, one curriculum. It doesn't have to be Free Code Camp. If you want to learn Ruby, for example, the Odin Project, my friend Eric runs the Odin Project. It's a great Ruby curriculum, and it covers a lot of stuff. A lot of people use the Odin Project in conjunction with Free Code Camp. So there are so many things that you could be doing, but just make sure that you spend most of your time, the lion's share of your time, coding.
Mm-hmm. Definitely great advice. So next, let's do some shout outs. Do you have a couple for us?
Absolutely. First of all, there's this great new boilerplate for JavaScript called Clementine.js, like the fruit. And basically, it will start you off with a very basic mean stack implementation. It just has Node, Express, Mongoose, Passport, which is the authentication library that I mentioned earlier. And Basically, you can optionally choose whether you want to add Angular. And it's a tutorial. Like, it shows you how to install all this stuff from scratch and get Mongo running and everything. And then how to build up this extremely fundamental app that uses like jQuery Ajax or Angular if you want. And you can alternatively just clone the repo and you've got like a basic functional mean stack app with authentication. It's super light. I think it's only like a few kilobytes. Including all the dependencies, like it's like less than 100 kilobytes, I think. And it's just extremely simple. There are not very many files there. It's just as minimal and lightweight as possible. So that was built by a camper named Blake Johnston. And nice. We're now incorporating that into our curriculum. We quit using, wow. We were using Mean.js, and then we were using Yeoman Angular full stack generator. But people were like, man, this is like the proverbial kitchen sink. This is like a bazooka to kill a mosquito. So Clementine is perfect for learners because it's so transparent and you can just go and refer to the documentation, literally build it yourself if you want to know how it works.
That's a good name too.
Yeah. I mean, every time I'm using it, I just want some oranges so bad.
Right. Nice and healthy. There you go.
The other thing I'd like to recommend, if you all are on a Mac, which, I mean, I really do recommend getting a Mac. Like, yeah, it's a lot of money, but I used this app and like tracked how many hours I used my laptop last year, and it was like 3,500 hours. Like wow. My MacBook Air was like $1,500 or whatever, like fully decked out. And yeah, it was like 50 cents an hour if I only used it for a year, but I've used it for 2.5. So it's definitely worth it. So there's an app for Mac that's just profoundly useful. It's called Alfred. And it is basically, it turns your entire operating system into a command line. It's like Spotlight on steroids. And it's so much faster than Spotlight because instead of searching the entire file system, it just grabs like the apps, and it has a few key things. Like at any time, you can just hit the Alfred hotkey and type something in and like Google it or go to like find it on Wikipedia. It's got like really sane defaults. And then you can write your own scripts. So for example, like I can write little like queries that will use a URL to go fetch a specific repo on GitHub. And I can just pass the repo name as a parameter essentially to my command. It makes a lot more sense if you actually like sit down and use it, but it's free. If you want, you can upgrade for $20 lifetime. Like that's the lifetime upgrade, and it's called the Power Pack. And then you get like this clipboard manager, which I make extensive use of because, like I said, I literally am interacting with like hundreds, some days thousand, like more than 1,000 campers in one day through all the different social media channels and email and everything. And a lot of times I answer the same question. So I've got this clipboard manager, and it allows me to just kind of like pull up little strings of text that I've frequently used. And you can search through them. It's full text searchable. So just freaking Alfred, go download it. It's amazing. And if you like it, get the Power Pack.
Nice. I didn't even know they had a Power Pack. Huh. And for my shout out, Quincy, I'm surprised you didn't mention this, but Free Code Camp has a really awesome blog on Medium. And they are inviting all of you to pitch your stories and share your coding experiences. And I highly encourage you all to do so. And they have a backlog of all of their blogs, their blog posts on there, including one which I really loved and took note of, the one, Quincy, where you talked about how you used to be on Slack and then you moved to Gitter. I think like 5 different people sent me that blog post, and we're wary of that limitation as well. So thank you so much for writing that blog post. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you very much for shouting it out. We would love your submissions. Yeah. And either way, like I'm the editor of that Medium publication. Hopefully somebody with a journalism background who also knows how to code will step forward and relieve me of that responsibility. That would be wonderful. But yeah, please do submit. And we would love anybody's content. It's a great way. You'll get probably at least 1,000 views on whatever you post on there.
Wow. That's wonderful. So if you want to join the conversation, you can join us on Code Newbie Discourse, our online forum for people excited about code, or you can chat with us every week on the Code Newbie Twitter chat. Just search for #CodeNewbie and tweet with us every Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. You can learn more about that as well as show notes on this episode at codenewbie.org/podcast. If there's a topic you want to hear about or a guest you want to hear from, send us an email, hello@codenewbie.org. Thank you again, Quincy, so much for joining us. This was an absolute treat. You want to say goodbye?
Happy coding, everybody.
Thanks for listening. See you next week.